with Bill Maher, executive producer Scott Carter, author and music critic Bob Mayer, and Emmy-nominated astronomer and artist Dr. Jose Salgado. And now, here's your host, a man who is thinking about an all-linen summer, Justin Kaufman.
I mean, that could be my look, right? I could just be like linen pants, linen flowing linen. Let's not mistake it. I'm not going tight linen, flowing linen. That could be my thing. I could walk around. I could kind of be like a Michigan Avenue attraction. Look at the guy in linen. Man, Chicago's so linen. That could work, right? Everybody's got to have a thing. And that would be my thing. Welcome to The Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman here on WGN Radio with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a great show for you on this great weekend. We got some nice weather coming through town, finally. I'm excited to be sort of your entry to the weekend. Whether or not you're getting out of town, or maybe you're just getting off work, ready to kick back, maybe drink one of the beers that Rokan and company recommended. Or maybe you got to work like us, right? But you're happy that maybe this is the last day of the week you got to work, you got the weekend off, or maybe you're a different, maybe this is your last day off and you work on the weekends. Whatever it is, we're here for you tonight on The Download. We got a great show. Scott Carter is here. He is the executive producer of Real Time with Bill Maher. As I said, the crosstalk with Roe, 1,100 plus episodes he has produced with Bill Maher. That goes back to the days at Comedy Central with Politically Incorrect when he made the move to ABC. And, of course, what he's doing on HBO now. He's got a new show at Northlight Theater in Skokie. The reviews are great for this show. The show is called The Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy. It's called Discord. It's interesting. It's about the three obviously historic writers and thinkers of our time, or, you know, as humankind. They all, at one point or another, made their own Bible. Isn't that interesting? Like they were scholars, they read the Bible, and they said, I can make it better, or I want to do my own Bible, or this is what I think about God. And so his play is about the three of them comparing notes and contrasting notes, really, on stage at the Northlight. Also tonight, I'm excited to talk to Bob Mayer. Bob, music critic, used to be with the Chicago Reader. Now he's with the Commercial Appeal in Memphis, newspaper down there. He wrote the book on The Replacements, which you love, Pete. You're the one who, you're the one who actually brought it to our attention.
I did. I read that book on my honeymoon. And
seems right. Seems appropriate.
And it was, my wife would say, you know, let's take a romantic walk on the beach. I'm like, you know, there's a great story about a romantic walk on the beach and The Replacements. Everything that we did, I tied it into The Replacements. Something happened to The Replacements that happens in life. But it was, yeah, it's a great book.
It's a big book, I'll say that. But it's tremendous. It's a tremendous story, you know, and it's not sort of what we see in pop culture. Like, let's tell about the rise and fall of this band. Everything was going great, and then it wasn't.
No,
it's a story that is well-researched, that's in-depth, that has interviews from Paul Westerberg and the players that were in The Replacements, and essentially, like, sets up their childhood, which is really dysfunctional. It sort of uses rock and roll as the tonic and also the toxic, because they use rock and roll to escape from their lives, and ultimately rock and roll is what kills them. And it's, I mean, I think it's a cautionary tale, but it's also an interesting way to look at the way that musicians interact with excess, whether it be alcohol, addiction, abuse, those kind of things. So we'll talk with Bob Mayer coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And it's also 10 o'clock Friday night. You know what time it is. It's time for The Frying Pan. Local innovator and entrepreneur Steve Gadlin is back tonight with a new invention. He's excited. He's been texting me all week, so he's ready to go.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. You see, I mean, it's fun. I mean, up to this point, I don't know if I know anybody with such resiliency. Because each week he comes out of this so dejected, because the Download Nation just really, really gives him a good workshop. Mm. And it doesn't usually work out because, you know, the ideas aren't that great. But he comes back and he spends the week working on it, and he has a soul. The two things that he wants to do in life is have a successful frying pan and to live with Rob Martyr. Those are the two things that Steve Gadlin really wants. So Steve Gadlin will be with us after 10 o'clock tonight. Much, much more. We're going to talk about handling police misconduct files. We're going to talk about the relationship between music and science and much, much more tonight here on The Download. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martyr. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman, and I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, The Carryout. Stay with us. This is The Download here on 720 WGN. It's time for The Carryout. This, of course, is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. The NRA has officially endorsed Donald Trump for president. Trump then acted like he's been a huge gun supporter, which, come on, he's a New York billionaire. You really think he's pro-gun? But he took the endorsement and he slammed Hillary Clinton's record on guns and then just lied and said that Hillary would take away our rights to bear arms, something she's never said. While this was going down, a man was shot by the Secret Service when he approached the White House with a gun. Ah, America, you complicated. The Mexican government approved the extradition of El Chapo Guzman to the United States. Where will he end up? Will it be in New York City or Chicago? It really comes down to which city does the best PowerPoint presentation. Chicago should send the Lovables and a bunch of Garrett's popcorn to try and win this extradition. Maybe see if the band Chicago will play for the Mexican government. Do it! Because you know that New York City's going to send Billy Joel. Sing us a song, yo, Mr. El Chapo. You know he's going to do that. Yesterday, Republican lawmakers in Oklahoma made abortions illegal, and today they want to impeach President Obama over bathrooms. They know they can't do that, right? Like, nobody cares what they think. Oklahoma lawmakers really just want the spotlight. I think what they did is they got together and were like, hey, what do you think if we just tried acid for like 3 days? I'll bet you we'd get a ton done. What else? TSA lines? Should we talk about that again? Because now the headlines are like, flyers brace for long lines as summer travel begins. Summer travel begins after Memorial Day. So are you saying that we should be bracing for longer lines? Is that really what we're doing? Getting worse instead of better? Great. Like I said, America, you complicated. Hey, there's lead in the water at a CPS elementary school, which really can't surprise anyone, right? I mean, I think we should just be surprised that the water fountains actually worked. Anyway, you know this is just the first, and I really can't wait for this to be the story of the summer, the story of 2016. Just you watch. The red planet Mars will be visible this weekend from Earth, so you can take your kids out in the yard, point to the sky, and say, see that reddish dot? Sometime in the future, we're going to ruin that planet, too. In weather, sneaky great today. Kind of sneaky great. Although I guess El Nino means that we're going to be having a super hot summer and not in a Rihanna concert kind of way, just super hot. Great. In sports, what a baseball weekend. The Cubs throw Jake Arrieta against the Giants tonight in San Francisco. That's going to be a real test. So far, the Cubs have really played down to their competition. The Giants, although, have won 8 in a row, and they're at the top of the NL West. So here we go, Cubs. On the South side, the defending World Series champs are coming to town. The Royals are 4.5 games back, but playing well after a crappy start. Jose Quintana tries to keep the Sox streak going after Chris Sale won his 9th game last night. 9-0. Come on now. Those are like Lamar Hoyt numbers. Actually, Lamar Hoyt's like 3 Chris Sales, but still, Hoyt numbers. In basketball, LeBron James and the Cavs won again last night. They are 10-0 in the playoffs. Talk about playing possum all year. Everyone is looking at the Warriors, but watch out. This could be the year that the Cleveland Cavaliers bring home the NBA World Championship. Ugh. And finally, it's going to be nice this weekend, but according to the CDC, 1 in 8 public pools in this country are straight up gross. And that's my public service announcement before you have a great weekend. Have a great weekend. That's the carryout for May 20th, 2016. Hey, do you like sushi? Because we're doing a special half-off sushi. Because let's face it, the full-price sushi didn't sell.
Coming up, we're going to talk police misconduct files. Will Springfield act to make them permanent? We'll find out
Also, coming up 8 o'clock, Real Time with Bill Maher, Scott Carter. It's a download on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I'm doing well. Busy day today, news-wise.
Yeah, there was a lot going on. Wasn't
crazy,
there?
And not all of it good, unfortunately.
Yeah, it seems like Fridays can go one way or the other, right? Seems like slow news day to begin with, or people trying to dump news stories at the end, or you get kind of the stories today where it just seems a lot of violence.
Well, the day got rolling when a judge ruled that it looks as though Mayor Emanuel is going to have to testify in this, you know, unwritten rule, this thin blue line, code of silence.
So interesting, isn't it?
Very interesting. That's going to be fun to follow. And then, of course, we had the huge raid, which I'm going to talk about here in the news on behalf of the Chicago Police Department. While that was going on, and some unfortunate, and this woman got, unfortunately, was killed. She was not targeted, but right outside basically CPD headquarters. So.
Yeah, we're going to talk coming up after the news about a little bit about the thin blue line, just in general, the police misconduct files. Mm-hmm. We had Jamie Calvin on, and he had sued to get them to be public, and they won the case. It took forever, it took years. But the Chicago Police Department has a little clause in the contract that says after 5 years, any police misconduct file gets permanently deleted. And they're trying to say, well, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't serve anybody but the police officer, and that's right. What the contract says. So they're essentially trying to get Springfield to write a law, which there's a bill in Springfield that would make that that go away.
Well, yeah, part of the current contract that CPD has with the city, in lieu of higher pay, they receive, the police, that is, more security, if you will, from these types of things.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's almost flies in the face of transparency, but at the same time, it's been something that Chicago the Police Department has done forever. Right. So we're going to talk about that after the news. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Scott Carter's going to be here from Real Time with Bill Maher. He's the executive producer of that program, and he's been with Bill Maher pretty much his entire career on television, 1,100-plus episodes. And we'll talk with him about what it takes to put on a show like Real Time, and also talk about his new play, which is up at the Northlight Theater. But first, back in 2007, Judge Joan Lefkoe ruled in favor of releasing Chicago police misconduct files. Up to that point, they were secret. In her ruling, she said, without such information, the public would be unable to supervise the individuals and institutions it has entrusted with extraordinary authority to arrest and detain persons against their will. With so much at stake, the defendants simply cannot be permitted to operate in secrecy. This played out in court for a while, and then finally in 2014, the documents were released and the Citizens Police Data Project was born. But see, that's not the end. There's an item in the Chicago Police Department contract that says that misconduct files will be permanently deleted after 5 years. And the FOP sued in 2014 to enforce that contract because the police department had been holding on to the records, even though the contract said not to. They've been doing that all the way back since 1967. A couple bills are winding their way through Springfield to make it illegal for misconduct files to be destroyed. But will lawmakers bring the bills to a vote before the end of the spring session in less than 2 weeks? Samantha Lisco is a civil rights lawyer, and she represented Jamie Calvin in the case Calvin versus Chicago, which made police misconduct files open to the public. Samantha, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So let's talk about, I mean, back in 2007, how did you get involved in this case? Because we had Jamie on. He was a guest here not too long ago, and we talked about his involvement. But how did you get involved in the Calvin versus Chicago?
So I was bringing civil rights cases in federal court, cases against the police department and police officers who had violated my client's constitutional rights. It was false arrest. It was excessive force. And so I would get the files regarding the complaints that citizens had lodged against these officers. And I thought, and also they showed what the city had done to investigate these complaints or not investigate in some cases. And I thought,
in most cases, but go ahead.
In most cases. And I thought, this is information that the public could really benefit from.
And at that time, that wasn't happening, right?
It wasn't happening. So to get those files, I had to agree, and a judge would enter what's called a protective order that meant that the parties, the lawyers and the plaintiff and the defendant, could see those records, but the public never could. And we started to challenge that. My firm said, you know, what's with this? We don't think this is beneficial to anyone not to have this information. For example, at the time, the city council, they still are the supervisor of the police department. They weren't getting these records. And when we filed suit to make these public, the city council said, you know what, that would be helpful to us.
Right.
But at the time, Mayor Daley was in office, and his lawyer, who was also the lawyer for the city council, said, no, you're not going to have these records. And so that played out in court for a while. The federal appeals court said, you know, no, we're not going to let you have these at this time. And we went to state court and went under the Freedom of Information Act.
Right.
And that's when the Illinois appellate court said, yes, under FOIA, the public has a right to these because officers are public servants. So these documents are about what they do on the job. They have these positions where they can arrest. They can even kill people. With that comes accountability. People need to see what they're doing and how the city's responding.
And essentially, that's at the core issue when we talk about the mayor being transparent or the police department being transparent. That's what this means. I mean, the idea that, you know, there isn't anything that you do in secrecy just because you're the police, and that's a big job, and, you know, and it's a hard job. Those records should be public.
And people have come around to this. So at the time, it was sort of, it seemed like a little bit of a, if not a losing battle, a real uphill battle to make this argument. Now, the release of the task force report, they said this provision in the union contract saying all records 5 years old or older should be destroyed is absolutely counterproductive. And here we are at a time when the Justice Department is coming in to look at the police department, when the city is saying that they're going to make serious reforms. Well, this is a bunch of knowledge about how was the police department working or not working. What can we do to look at that to see what mistakes were made or what beneficial things were done and use that to move forward. Instead, we're looking at, you know, reconstituting or this investigatory agency. We had IPRA, now Emmanuel, saying, let's scrap that. But what are we going to put in its place? Something that we're going to create from, you know, nothing with no information? That's totally counterproductive. And, you know, the Illinois Attorney General agrees with us. The city of Chicago agrees. They've said, please don't destroy these
records. Right. Okay, so let's talk about that, because the obviously the citizens, the Citizen Data Project, that was something that came out and was very, very instrumental in what we saw with the case with Laquan McDonald and others, where you could go back and see with Officer Jason Van Dyke some of the things, the complaints he had. You also can see other situations where police officers, and it's a very small handful percentage of police officers, have registered a long list of complaints. Where did it come from where this arbitrary number gets into a police contract? What's behind the idea that after 5 years, these permanent records will be deleted?
Well, the Tribune talked about this today in an interesting article. They went and looked at the history of these collective bargaining agreements. And, you know, officers totally deserve due process. If you are recommended for termination, you get to go to an arbitrator or the other court and say, I challenge that. That's fine. What the department's been, what the police have been given over the years is a lot of gifts. Basically, for example, you know, they don't have to, at a police shooting site, those officers get a minimum of 24 hours before they're interviewed. And that means they can get their story straight. And as we saw with the Laquan McDonald case, all those officers had their story exactly straight. It was the same story. The problem was, it was polar opposite from what we saw on that video. There's a lot of problematic provisions in there. And what the Tribune said is, maybe at different points when the union contracts were being negotiated, the city didn't feel like it had money to give to the officers, so it said, here, we'll give you these
provisions. Just like Rob said right before the news, instead of saying, okay, we're going to give you competitive wage, which, you know, or more money, we can give you these provisions that will protect security, or at least in their mind say it's secure. So a lot of the transparency issues really are around job security.
And you mentioned the Citizen Data Project. You can go see that at the Invisible Institute website. It's fantastic. And I'll give you an example of how, so that's some data. We got some data from our lawsuit, but the vast majority is behind this wall, and it's at risk of being destroyed. But the little that we have gotten has shown us, for example, there was a story in the Tribune last week about judges are starting to question, publicly question officers who come into criminal court and say, you know, that woman, she just dropped her heroin, her bag of heroin right in front of me. That's how I found her drugs. And they're saying, you're lying. And so judges are starting to say, you can't come in my courtroom and lie. And they named some of these officers. And I looked up some of these officers. And lo and behold, you know, a lot of them have 10, 15 complaints, sometimes of false arrest, of verbal abuse, things that are very relevant to the department in looking at an officer and saying, is there trouble brewing? What can we do about these officers? I mean, the task force report said there's been these points throughout the history of the department where they try to implement what's called pattern analysis, where we're going to look at, okay, where are trouble spots? Where are the people who might ultimately end up doing something like shooting a 16-year-old boy? And they dropped it over the years. And the union contract has a lot to do with why.
Well, I mean, data plays a big role. I mean, regardless of, you know, the politics of this, data can show where someone is accruing complaint after complaint after complaint. And maybe it's because they're in a situation that they're not trained on, or maybe there's a lot of data analysis that can go into policing. I know the police use data. That's something that actually has seen a lot in the last couple of years under Superintendent McCarthy, that data has been a bigger thing. But, you know, is this the kind of thing that we can trust that they were doing without it being public? Were they behind this big wall where we couldn't see it actually using this data to go, oh, you know, it's his 10th complaint? Because most of the time we don't see it.
It's established they weren't using the data. They were not the data about the police officers, maybe about crime stats and the communities, not about the police. And if they're not going to use it, which I hope that they will now, if it still exists, that's the problem. That's why we're pushing on Springfield. If it gets deleted, well, then no one's going to do anything with the data. But if the police department going forward doesn't want, or even if they're using it, the public can also use it. And you don't have to even be a trained journalist or data analyst to go on a site like the Invisible Institute
and look at this.
I mean, basically, every time I go on that site, I think I just sort of poke around and find something new and interesting. Everyone can do that. Everyone can be active citizen participants. But if this data is destroyed, then basically all the investigatory files that were going to be matched up with what we have are going to be gone. It's going to be much less useful.
Now, lawmakers were up to a certain point in the spring session. They were behind this. There are a few bills that were circulating. There's some movement on this. But the question was whether or not this was going to get pushed through in the spring session. That would there be a law that or a bill that would go to Governor Rauner's desk that would essentially say that misconduct files cannot be deleted? Are we going to see that law? I mean, are there politicians, namely leaders in Springfield, that are looking at this and may bring it to a vote?
If you'd asked me a week ago, is this going to happen? I would have said, of course. They're all aware in Springfield of how urgent this is. Now I'm questioning it because it's stalled out, and I'm wondering if legislators are thinking this couldn't happen. There wouldn't be a deletion, a bonfire of 50 years of police data. But I'm here to say there will be. The arbitrator has ruled, and he put on hold his ruling for just a teeny bit while the DOJ does its investigation. And he specifically said just a month ago, when that DOJ investigation is over, these records will be destroyed. And so to the extent that any legislators are thinking this is something that can happen in the fall or next year, it can't. It has to happen now. And people can contact their legislators. Right. You know, there's a site called openstates.org where you can click on find your legislator, put in your address, and then you can get their phone number and you can call.
Let me ask you this as just sort of a counter argument to this. And you'll hear this a lot from police officers who say, you know, my personnel record is not open to the public. Your personnel record is not open to the public. Any complaints against us isn't something that can be up for. And this is what it's actually called in the contract, public humiliation. Do police officers as public servants, you know, do they have to have their complaints be public? I mean, is there anything to that merit, to that argument, that counter argument that maybe this stuff isn't for the general public?
In our case, the Illinois Appellate Court said these are public servants. This is about their public job. These are public. But it is an understandable concern. Why? Because the police officers in this city have not ever had to have any information about, you know, complaints against them out in the public. However, I believe that there are plenty of officers who can't say this. There's a code of silence in the department. Rahm Emanuel just acknowledged this. Who wouldn't come out and say publicly that they want this data out there. But I think some of them would, because there are the problem officers. They're the ones who probably have something to fear, humiliation and other repercussions from having that information out there. But so many officers have to have their reputations harmed, have to watch the reputation of the department be absolutely destroyed by these officers. And I think more information, I mean, if you're an officer and you had a frivolous complaint lodged against you, that investigation file, you can see it. We can see, oh, that was silly. More information is the cure for secrecy, is the cure for, you know, for what ails the department.
Yeah.
And not the opposite.
You would think that might be, it might actually, you're right, it might actually have a sort of effect where police officers can essentially weed out bad officers, which is a small number percentage that we're learning about, but it's good to know that as opposed to indicting an entire police force.
Yeah, people might see that, wow, there are a lot of officers out there who have had zero complaints or one or two minor, and that's going to be positive. But, you know, we also need to look at, the most important thing is, how does the city handle it? How do they investigate? And, you know, I've seen these files and there's some pretty paltry investigations. And, you know, once those investigations are public, there's going to be a lot of opportunity to understand, how do you do a real investigation? How do you take this seriously?
Well, we'll see what happens in the next 2 weeks if Springfield's going to pick this up and, you know, pass and put something to Governor Rauner on making sure that police misconduct files aren't deleted. It is an immediate situation because you could see in the summertime, you know, police being able to do that based on their contract. Samantha Lisco is a civil rights lawyer. She represented Jamie Calvin in the case Calvin versus Chicago, which made police misconduct files open to the public. Samantha, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. Coming up, Scott Carter is the executive producer of Real Time with Bill Maher. Great conversation with Samantha Lisco there. And I'm getting a lot of texts about it. You know, I know that we have a lot of police officers who listen and are part of it. And I think you get both ways. I'm hearing it both ways. You know, I'm hearing it, you know, you want to protect that data because there's a lot of bogus beefs. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there and really it's essentially saying that if the public, and what they mean by the public is the media, if the media gets a hold of bogus beefs, then every third page of the Chicago Sun-Times and Chicago Tribune is going to be, look at this bad cop, look at this bad cop, and people are just going to hate cops. But I would make the argument, and it's made here as well in Texas, you know, this is an effort to root out bad actors, right? I mean, that's the point. The point saying that if you do that and you actually see some investigations, you know, bear fruit against police officers who have, you know, tens of hundreds of complaints against them, that the public will bring some, there'll be some credibility that will be restored. So if you were a good police officer and you have an upstanding record, and even if you do have violations, as Samantha said, I mean, that you could see the investigation, you could see the investigative process. And you know, I don't think that you're going to see, you know, irresponsible journalists that are like, oh, there's one. I think it's more about systemic secrecy and the idea that you know, we were just looking at it before. Jason Van Dyke, the officer in the Laquan McDonald, he had a long list of complaints, including lawsuits that the city had to pay out before Laquan McDonald. So just alone, he's over $1 million in payouts that the city had to pay. Now, you know, maybe at some points, because that information's public, and maybe there's a little bit more of saying, you could see this guy's that he's not in that situation that, you know, is going to cost the city money and be in a situation where something like what happens with Laquan McDonald happens. I don't know. Maybe that's too utopian in the way I'm looking at it. But I don't necessarily want the information public so it's a witch hunt.
Right. No, yeah, of course.
Right?
Yeah.
That's not as a member of the media. I just think that it makes a lot more sense when you see a police officer who is involved in something and then you can go cross-check and you're like, oh, he's had 25 misconduct complaints and none of them have been investigated. As Samantha said, it might be more about why are they not being investigated. So I don't know. I think as you look at how to sort of reform and remodel the Chicago Police Department, that it has to be a part of it, right?
Yeah.
I think that's fair and objective, and I'm not on one side or the other. I think that Chicago police officers get a bad rap half the time, and I think it's
because
and I think it's because it's not transparent. because it's secret, we just go Chicago cops.
Right.
And you're like, no, it's not Chicago cops. And there are some cops that get bogus beefs, and I understand it because they are in war zones. They are in, you know, as we speak, you know, trying to get gang members to not shoot at each other while they're innocent bystanders standing in front of them. And then someone goes, oh, the cops, I'm going to complain against that cop. So I can understand that. But I think as a society at large, I think that we are a thoughtful civil society that would understand that there are pressures in that. It's not the idea that we're just like, yep, there's one. This is about rooting out corruption and systemic complaints. Right? All right, now we'll talk comedy. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the reviews are in for the new show at Northlight Theater in Skokie. The show, The Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy, Discord, is a hit. Both the Sun-Times and the Tribune gave glowing reviews. It's a play that puts three of the best minds of all time together in a room debating religion and politics. What could be better? The play was written in 2014 by Scott Carter. Carter is a former stand-up comedian and actor who's performed everywhere from the Edinburgh Fringe Festival to the Aspen Comedy Fest. Carter's currently the executive producer of the HBO show Real Time with Bill Maher. He also was with Maher on Politically Incorrect, where Carter produced 1,100 episodes. Scott Carter is my guest tonight at the big table. Scott, welcome to the show. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Justin. It's a pleasure to be here, and I love Chicago whenever I'm here, and it's just such a wonderful city.
Well, let's talk about the play. I mean, this is something that you've been working on for a long time.
I got the first seed of this in 1987 following a near-death asthma attack that I had that put me in the hospital for about a week, and when I came out of the hospital, I had this kind of epiphany about the urgency of dealing with the big questions of life. And I'd always kind of poo-pooed. I'd been indifferent or hostile to the notion of religion, and I wasn't raised in any kind of strict religious household. But I made this vow with the universe that for the next couple of years at least, if anybody wanted to talk to me about religion, I would have to listen. So if I was walking down the street in New York, where I was a stand-up comic at the time, and somebody with a Mr. Microphone was haranguing a crowd, I couldn't keep walking. I would have to stop. And I would have to listen until I figured that I got the essence of what he was saying, he or she was saying, then I could walk on. Or if somebody on the street was handing me a pamphlet, I would have to take it. I had a Jehovah's Witness come to my apartment every Wednesday at 1 o'clock for 2 years. And each Wednesday he would come in, I would put him on the sofa, give him a glass of water, he would talk to me for an hour, and at the end of the hour I would say, Kim, once again, I do not agree with anything you believe, and I will see you next week.
That has to be, that is wildly ambitious for religion to be able to be open for this, but it's also exhausting, the idea of listening to everybody pitch their certain specific religion.
Well, I had come so close to being dead that I thought I needed to be considering perhaps interpretations of life that perhaps before that time I had just disregarded. Now I had to at least consider them. And it led me to one of the things that happened at the time was Bill Moyers had this wonderful show called World of Ideas. And one day he was interviewing a fellow named Forrester Church, who was a Unitarian minister on Madison Avenue in New York. And he started talking about the Jefferson Bible. And Jefferson, one of the most incredible people who ever lived, at night, while living in the White House — he was the first president to live 8 years in the White House, although he called it the President's House. They didn't call it the White House then. He got two copies of the same edition of the Bible. And then he went through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four Gospels, with a razor. And he cut out all of the verses that he liked. And then he got a blank scrapbook. And with a pot of paste, he made the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four different stories. He made his little pieces into an original new gospel. And then when he retired, he left Washington in March of 1809 and went back to Monticello, never came back to Washington again. And in 1820, 6 years before he died at the age of 83 on July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration, the same day as John Adams. He made a more advanced copy of this, where he got two copies each in Greek, Latin, French, and English. And so he, so if you read it across, you can see the same verse in four different languages, or you can read it down in any of the languages. Jefferson read six or seven different languages. And he kept this a secret from his family. Wow. So they only found out about it after he died. And then they kept it in their family until, and they had no money. 6 months after he dies, Monticello is sold. They finally sell to the Smithsonian, this existing copy of the Jefferson Bible, for $500 in 1898. Then in 1902, there's a U.S. representative who passes a bill to print 9,000 photocopies of it and give them out to new senators and congressmen as they come to Washington. And so Forrester Church's father was Frank Church, senator from Idaho. Mm. He got a copy of the Jefferson Bible, brings it home, gives it to his son, and his son is so struck by it, he then becomes a minister. He goes to Harvard Divinity, becomes a Unitarian minister, which Unitarian was one of the sects that Jefferson was most compatible with because it was one of the least dogmatic. So anyway, so then I thought, well, there's some sort of play. There's something here. And I got a copy of the Jefferson Bible. And you're reading it. And what you see is you'll see like three verses from John and then two from Mark and then six from Luke. And so I thought, well, maybe there's something here. Maybe it's two one-act plays. And the first is Jefferson's dying and the nature of the American democracy and how that's going to live after he dies. And then maybe the second half is the story of Jesus. And it's kind of putting together, making a parallel. And there were three or four different ideas like that that I had that I worked for a long time on. Then in 1996, Politically Incorrect had moved to L.A. I was in my local bookstore and saw the spine of a book called The Life of Our Lord by Charles Dickens. And I'd never heard of this before. I thought I knew all the Dickens titles. So I get it down and then I open it up and I realize Dickens did the exact same thing that Jefferson did, except all of his choices were the exact opposite. Because Jefferson gets rid of all the miracles. And the miracles are what Dickens loves.
And you don't think of Thomas Jefferson or Dickens or Tolstoy, for that matter, in this kind of way where they're going to be that into, you know, recreating or reassembling the Bible. That's not something that necessarily you would think of those historical figures.
Well, Jefferson only let three or four of his best friends know about it because he was afraid that his political enemies would find out and make an allegation that he was not a Christian or make an allegation that he was not religious at all, which had already come up when he had the letter to the Danbury priests about the separation of church and state. He was already the enemy of all of the clerics in the country.
So they wouldn't look too kindly to him doing an abridged version of the Bible.
No, and furthermore, he's opposed to them. I mean, there's a line in the play which is taken from Jefferson where he says, it's priests who are the real antichrists. Of these three volumes, Jefferson, Dickens, Tolstoy, none of them were published in that person's country in their own lifetime. So Jefferson kept it to himself. Dickens, when he died, he left a three-page will. One of the provisions in the will was that his Bible could not be published until the last of his children died. Well, he had 10 kids.
Wow. Is that for protection?
So he dies in eight. Well, he did it for them. When the fifth was born, he did his own gospel, and he read it to them so often that all of them could recite it by memory before they had learned to read and write themselves. And he eventually had 10 kids. So the last of his kids did not die until 1933, 63 years after he died. And so it was published in 1934. And then Tolstoy, by the time he finished this, his Gospels in Brief, he couldn't publish anymore in Russia. So in those days, he would have to get one of his confederates to take manuscripts, take them to Switzerland or some other country where they'd be translated and published and then distributed out from there. So it's not like, I mean, Tolstoy was a proselytizer. He was evangelical for own eccentric notions. But Jefferson and Dickens would not necessarily have wanted you to know all about their religious feelings.
And that's the basis of the play.
Yes.
The Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy, Discord. It's them discussing together their versions and sort of picking each other's apart.
They are trapped in a sort of limbo where each thinks his path to salvation depends upon convincing the other two that they are wrong. So it's these three alpha males who are used to no one contradicting
them. Well, I have so many questions about this. Okay. Scott Carter is the playwright. He's also currently the executive producer of the HBO show Real Time with Bill Maher. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight, the big table, Scott Carter. He's currently the executive producer of the HBO show Real Time with Bill Maher. He's got a show up at the Northlight Theater called The Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy, Discord. It's running till June 12th. All right. To be able to get everyone's gospel together is one thing. How do you make that a play? How do you make that a transition for those kind of works and be able to transfer it to the stage?
If I were smarter, I might have figured out a way to do it quicker. But it's now 29 years since I got the first idea on this. So I've done at least 100 drafts. I got the first draft was finished in 2005 of sort of the current version. And everybody hated it. My wife hated it. My lawyer hated it. My agent hated it. Everybody. So I just put it away. And then,
they're like, stick to TV. Right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're doing well.
What are you doing?
Yeah, yeah. So, and I've been continuously working in TV since 1988. So there was a break in 2008. So I went back to the script. And because I'd let it gestate for 3 years, I now looked at it and saw, oh, this belongs in the play and this doesn't. So I boiled what had been a 151, 10-point type kitchen sink of a play that was a mess. I agreed with all the people who detested it. I boiled it down to about 50 pages. And then I called Gary Shandling, who is a friend of mine. We grew up together. We didn't grow up together, but we both grew up in Tucson. We went to the same high school. We became friends later on. But I called him up and said, I've got this thing I've been working on for so long. I've never told you about it. Can I come over to your house and just read it to you? And so he said, yeah, let's have dinner. So come on over. So what I did was I went over to his house. We have dinner on the dining room table. Then we move everything aside. Then I got three sticks and I got pictures of Jefferson, Dickens, and Tolstoy and put them on the sticks and had a glass of water, had my script out in front of me, and then started reading. But I would hold up the stick for whoever was talking at the time so he would not be confused by my inability to do three different voices or do a Russian accent or an English accent.
That's where your performance background comes into play here.
Yeah, that's right. And we got about halfway through, and he said, let's just stop and talk about everything that I've heard so far. And then he gave me like 15 pages of notes. Mm. And then he looked at his watch and said, it's late. Why don't you come back tomorrow? So then I thought, like, I'm like Scheherazade. I'm coming back the next night. And I came back the next night. We finished it. And then I waited a week, looked at all of his notes, made a rewrite. And then the next house I went to was Norman Lear's. I did it at Arianna Huffington's house. I did it at Arianna Huffington's. It was a Christmas time. I didn't do it by myself. I had three actors reading the parts. And Shirley MacLaine was in the audience. And so afterwards, she said to me, we need to talk, and could we have lunch together? And I said, I would be delighted to have lunch with you, because that's one of the reasons one gets into show business is to have lunch with Shirley MacLaine.
Sure.
So she sits down and she says, first of all, I want you to know that the reason that the Star of Bethlehem hovered in the sky was that it was not a star, it was a spaceship. And then she said, but the reason I want to talk to you is that I want you to add Sir Isaac Newton to the cast of three people. Isaac Newton is who my friend Stephen Hawking, I believe, is the reincarnation of. And then, you know, I said to her, look, I've been working on this for so long. And if I keep adding characters, it will never get
the
finished.
The blocking alone. I mean, what are you going to do with an extra character in this, right?
Well, and also there would be two English people, you know. I mean, it's kind of nice that I've got an American, I've got an Englishman, and then I've got, you know, a Russian. And that kind of all works. The three that we've got are perfect. And people will say to me, why'd you pick these three? No, they picked me because they all did the exact same task.
Exactly. I was going to say, I'm not sure if Newton did a
He didn't. Yeah. He did some. Mark Twain. A lot of different writers have done little parodies of parts of the – but these are the only three I know who did exactly the same task.
Let me ask you, you know, I think of – there's a lot of theater we'll see on stage that's impersonations. But the concept being that there seems to be a lot of historical performances, characters that are brought out. This is different in the way that, you know, you put a play together and these three are going off their own gospels. But talk about how it is different and it's, you know, how do you get away from the idea that somebody comes out and a Thomas Jefferson says, hello, oh, look at that cell phone. You know, like that kind of thing that seems to what we see over and over and over with historical fiction or historical characters on stage.
Well, the way you do it is you're raising the stakes for the three characters involved, so it's not some sort of languid lecture of people telling you how great they were. I mean, from the very first moment, These three are in direct opposition with each other and think that the future of their the eternal fate of their souls hangs in the balance. And then at the beginning, you know, Jefferson lives first, so he's never heard of Dickens or Tolstoy. Dickens is next, so he's heard of Jefferson, but he doesn't know Tolstoy. Tolstoy does know the other two. But so for the first part, they're establishing each other to themselves. And they're figuring out because, I mean, for all three of them, for Jefferson and Tolstoy, they both lived on 1,000-acre estates where they were the patriarch of everything they saw. And for Dickens, Dickens was used to not only being the prime novelist of his day, but also he gave over 300 public readings where he would get 1,000, 1,500 people listen to him, both in Great Britain and in America. He came here twice, listened to him read from his work. So he was really, Dickens was really the first celebrity writer before Oscar Wilde, before Mark Twain. In fact, Mark Twain's first date with the woman who became his wife was to hear Dickens's last American lecture in New York at Cooper Union.
I mean, for you as a with a background in stand-up comedy performance, I mean, you're working with Bill Maher, and there's got to be some interesting similarities on creating a play that has to do with three characters discussing something and what you've done in television for decades now. How much did you know going in about these characters, historical figures, Dickens, Tolstoy, Jefferson? And do you consider yourself a scholar on these after having to write a play for 29 years?
I would say that in the beginning, I knew very little, and most of what I thought I knew was wrong. And so there's just been this joy of discovery as I've been reading and traveling to different places and seeing things and talking to people. And then, no, I'm not a scholar, but I have benefited from a lot of writers, theologians, historians who've looked at the manuscript, who've come to readings, who've come to the play, who've given me pointers and helped me correct, if anything. I mean, I want this to be within a fantastic setting. I want it to be absolutely as realistic as possible. And so that's why it's taken so many drafts. And that's why, I mean, there's a new great book out on Jefferson called The Most Blessed of Patriarchs by Annette Gordon Reed and Peter Onuf. And I'm reading it now and I'm thinking, I've got to do a little bit of rewriting. here's a good line of Jefferson's. Here's a better word than I've got. And let me shift that. So, for instance, he called Washington, D.C., he called it Washington City. He called the White House the President's House. And I'm thinking, well, that's just a couple lines. And then luckily, there's a published script now. But whenever they sell out a run, they told me, because I was very nervous about this, they said, well, when we do a second edition, you can make changes to the second edition. And that was like a blessing to me. That was bountiful news to me.
We're talking with Scott Carter here on Download the Show. The Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy. Discord is at the Northlight Theater in Skokie till June 12th. We'll continue our conversation with Scott when we return after the news. Stay with us. Is this long? Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest tonight at the big table, Scott Carter. He's the executive producer of Real Time with Bill Maher, and he's got a show on at the Northlight Theater in Skokie, The Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy, Discord. It's a hit, too. The Sun-Times and Tribune both loved it. The reviews are in. It's on stage until June 12th. And it really is tremendous. I mean, the amount of just you telling us in this first half of this interview about all of the things that you discovered and all of the research that went into this, this is much less than of a play and more of a like your thesis. Like, you know, like this is your life's work. This is,
well, but I hope audiences perceive it as an entertaining. I mean, I've been delighted by the reviews talking about how funny it is and how entertaining it is, because the last thing I want is for people to think that if they come, if they pay for a ticket, they're going to be submitting to a lecture.
Right.
And that it's going to feel like a dusty museum piece, and that I want it to be vibrant like a play by Tom Stoppard or one of the current English playwrights or someone like George Bernard Shaw or Oscar Wilde, who I'm a big fan of the English tradition of plays of ideas, and we don't have that as much in America, that's what this play is coming out of.
Well, I mean, you could – obviously your work in television – and you mentioned even earlier with Gary Shandling and the ability to have friends in Hollywood to be able to look at it, you're going to be able to create a show that moves, an entertaining show that moves. I mean, well, you're not going to be someone who doesn't have, you can't, you're not working in a bubble. You have so many people around you.
Well, a lot of what I do on Real Time is I'm the one that coalesces all the guests and gets them ready. I'm sort of a court-appointed lawyer to each of them in the final hours before the live taping. And so I'm orchestrating both conflict every night, but also the illumination of an idea and differing viewpoints to approach that idea. And so a lot of that came in really handy in this, and then also a lot of the people who appear on our show regularly have become friends, and a lot of them have come to see it in L.A. or different, or Washington. It was just in Washington, and I hope friends are going to come and see it in Chicago. But I'll give you an example. The late Christopher Hitchens, who taught a course in Jefferson and wrote a book, a very good small book on Jefferson called Thomas Jefferson, the Author of America. I was telling him about this, and he knew about the Jefferson Bible, didn't know about Dickens, didn't know about Tolstoy. So every time I saw him, he would be on the show twice a year. We would talk about the play. And there's a speech at the very end that Dickens has on slavery. And it comes from Christopher Hitchens pointing me to a very not well-known Dickens book called American Notes. After he came to America the first time, he did an essay. And his last chapter in the book is called Slavery. And a lot of the points that Dickens in the play makes come out of that. Mm. So I wouldn't have that speech if it weren't for Christopher Hitchens.
Well, there's something about Real Time and Politically Incorrect before that, that being able to bring together the viewpoints, you know, varied and with variety so that it's balanced is one thing. But there's another to do it with authenticity, to do it where it's not staged, where people feel, oh, okay, this is going to be, you know. And you said it before, we've kind of gone away from, on the stage, these ideas, these plays of ideas. But I would say in television as well, where, you know, you think back to Gore Vidal and you think back to some of the stuff that we were doing in television in the late 60s and 70s, where it was about the idea and putting it on. And the only thing I can think about that still does that is Real Time. That's the only show where people come on and they have real, authentic conversation. How much of that is part of what you have to do to get these people ready so they're not staged, they're not going back to their bullet points or their, you know, what they decided to bring in before the conversation started?
My main job in that respect is to get them relaxed enough to be actually listening to what the other people are saying, so that their next comment is not some pre-planned comment, mm-hmm. but a real response that carries the volley of ideas on. And then over a period of time, I mean, we now have a lot of people we know are always going to be good in our show. And then each week out of the five guests, we're generally testing one or two, mm-hmm. see if they're people we want to have come back. But it's one of the delights, and I feel like I am so privileged that each week, I mean, no matter what Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday are like around the office, Friday is always a delight, and then we have a little party, and then everyone goes, I mean, you know, one time we had Pat Buchanan's sister, Bay Buchanan, was on the show, and I said, now, Bay, after the show's over, we're going to have a little party, and we hope that you and your friends who are here will come to it. And she said, you're kidding. And I said, no, we have a little party after each show. And he goes, and she said, in Washington, when we do a show, we can't wait to get away from each other. and I said, that's so sad. So we have a little party every week, and then people go off for the weekend, and then we come back on Monday, and we make a new show
that
Friday.
That's telling, because I think of the Sunday morning talk shows and what word discourse is, that seems to be pre-planned. Everything about it now is a stop on the campaign trail, or that's where the pundits are going to do their thing, and you kind of know what episode every episode is going to be like. On the other side, you have Real Time, and before that, Politically Incorrect, where it almost feels like when those shows are humming at with the speed that you guys want them to be, it's when there's this sort of randomness, this authenticity, where there just seems to be kind of going off the rails a little bit.
And you mentioned Gore Vidal, and Bill and I are the two oldest people on the staff. So we remember Firing Line with William mm-hmm. F. Buckley.
That's great.
And Gore Vidal, Norman Mailer, these people who, when they would come on Dick Cavett or other shows, it felt so alive in a way that everything has kind of moved away from. And so we feel honored to be getting this last forum for it. And now we've been around so long that people really want to be on the show. I mean, there were times early on when, can we fill these chairs by showtime? Was our
that's hard to believe.
Yeah. But that was true. And then and now it's we are very lucky to have just Bernie Sanders is going to be on the next show, which is the 27th. He was first on Politically Incorrect in November of 1993.
When you guys started Politically Incorrect, I mean, to think now, I mean, it's obviously different iterations and it's real time now. It's a different but the concept of having different people with different disciplines get together, mostly, you know, you'd have one, you know, politician, maybe one journalist, one comedian. I mean, trying to step away from it, did you think it would have this kind of longevity? I mean, what was your thought moving into it? Do you think that people were going to accept it the way they did?
Well, the original idea came out of conversations that Bill used to have in his own living room with friends of his from different disciplines. And then when we were developing it before the first day of taping, I remember just saying to him, at that point, I've been doing TV for about 5 years and thought that how many more years can I be doing television before I've got to go back to the clubs and do comedy? And I said, look, this is a very strong idea. And very often what happens, the closer that an idea gets to its first day of taping, the more networks will sort of pressure you to want to hedge your bet and dilute the boldness of the idea. But I said, look, here's my pledge is we're not going to dilute this. We're going to have this is going to be the idea, and either it's going to work and it's going to be a big success, or it's going to completely fail, and it won't be the first television show that's failed. So let's have it be that. And so, you know, to his credit, I mean, he has always been a very firm believer in whatever ideas he has at that moment. He has complete conviction in them. There's never a time where he takes a stance on the show that he's just taking to be devil's advocate. Everything he says, he believes.
It's legitimate, yeah.
It's completely legitimate. And that makes it easy for the producers to be then booking people opposite him.
Right.
Because we know where he is.
I mean, one of the things I love about Real Time is the celebrity guests that will come on halfway through the show and be able to be the special guest on the show. A lot of them actors, a lot of comedians, a lot of people you wouldn't necessarily think are going to engage in this kind of conversation, a political conversation, religious conversation, what it might be a little more heady than whatever their movie is that's coming out on the next weekend. For you, finding those people is probably not that hard at this point because everyone wants to come on Real Time with Bill Maher. Is the job become making sure you have the right person who's going to have rapport, chemistry, and something to say?
Yes, because even though the mid-show interview is about 5 minutes, that can be a very long 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of actors and actresses who consider themselves to be political. And then when you find out what that means, it usually comes down to something like they don't like Trump or they hate George Bush or something. And it doesn't go much deeper than that. So we do a lot of work in both making sure that the people who come on can talk for 20, 25 minutes if they had to, that they have a depth of knowledge in what we're going to get them to do. The mid-show place has been a great spot for us in getting people who might not feel comfortable talking specifically about politics to come on to talk specifically about something that they care about.
Climate change or something like that.
A perfect example. So, you know, Mark Ruffalo is very well-versed in environmental causes, and he got this when he and his wife and family moved to upstate New York, and they started dealing with the results of fracking and what it was doing to their water supply and all this stuff. So he has actually testified in front of Congress. He's very well versed, really knows what he's talking about. I mean, there are a lot of people, Kerry Washington. I mean, there's just so many people who really know issues that they care about, and then that mid-show format is a great place for them.
What's great about the show is echoed as well in the play is this heady conversation about ideas. We're not getting – this happens on Real Time all the time where it could easily go down into, you know, the he said, she said, and it tries to. Trust me, the panel is political one way or the other. But it does – Bill seems to move it up to a more heady idea about the future of our planet, the future of politics, so how are we going to live together. Religion plays a huge role. Is that – easier said than done?
Well, the other part of Bill's considerable talent is he's sort of he's like a hedge fund manager for the conversation, that if it gets too in the weeds at some point, he makes a joke and brings it back up, and it's a counterbalance. And I would also say that, you know, after doing this for so long, he just has such a wealth of knowledge, and he's so clear on so many viewpoints. I just remember, I mean, he's off the air now, but when he would do Larry King, and he'd do an hour, and Larry King would just ask him a question at the beginning of each segment, and Bill would then talk for 7 or 8 minutes or whatever it was. They go to commercial, come back, ask him another question. And that if you came to our writers' meeting on a Tuesday, you would think it's a think tank that just happen to be populated by really funny people. That's what it is. But it's a room full of often brilliantly talented, really funny, witty people. But we're talking about the most serious
right.
issues that exist
Real
in
stuff,
the world.
Right. You're not writing a script. I mean, this is you are trying to find the topics that people care about. Last question about real time. Because of Bill and his very well-known politics, I mean, it does come across as a liberal show, almost like on one hand you have Bill O'Reilly, the other hand you have Bill Maher. Are you guys comfortable with that? Are you comfortable in this day and age having a show that is unabashedly liberal, that is the yin to the yang of maybe a Fox News?
But we'll criticize liberals in a way. I mean, I feel like he, in a way, on Fox, Bill O'Reilly, because of his ratings, he's one of the few on Fox who can kind of take on conservatives. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Bill's a little bit like that as a mostly liberal. But we also take on Democrats a lot. And the other thing that is a testimony to his talent and his character is the willingness to have really strong people on who are completely the opposite from his viewpoint. And he believes enough in what his own convictions are that he will let them be tested by having strong opponents.
Right. As we wrap up here, I mean, we talked about your play being life's work in the way that you spent 29 years on the play. It was just, you know, hit L.A. last year. It's now in Chicago at the Northlight through June 12th. But, you know, that plus, you know, Bill Maher, which Real Time and Politically Incorrect, I mean, how many episodes? I mean, you combine the two together, you're talking 1,200 episodes of television. When you get done with a project like the play that you just spent 29 years on, and you have a career of 1,200 episodes in the same, pretty much the same kind of show, what's next for you? I mean, do you feel like consistency is a big part of, like, you need a project to work on?
Well, first of all, I think that Real Time can keep going for a long, long time. As long as Bill wants to do the show, I think the network will let us keep the show. We're on through November right now. And so that could last for a long time. And then the play, I actually have a companion evening to Discord called Harmony.
Great.
And the basic premise of that is it takes place in a theater where Discord is being performed. And the three
Brilliant.
Characters yeah. are the three actors.
That's great.
And one of them thinks the other two have been doing it too long and they're getting tired and they're phoning it in. So he's called them to the dark theater on a dark afternoon to yell at them. And that's where the other play starts off.
Another 29 years on this one?
Well, no. I finished a first draft last year. I've already had a couple of readings, and I do not have at this point in my life, I will not be able to do one play every 30 years. I've got to work a little bit faster.
Well, Scott Carter's play that's at the Northlight Theater is called "The Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, Charles Dickens, and Count Leo Tolstoy: Discord." It's a hit. The Sun-Times and Tribune love it. It's on stage till June 12th. Carter is currently the executive producer of the HBO show Real Time with Bill Maher, and we'll be looking for Harmony sometime soon. Scott, thanks for joining me at the big table.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.
Coming up this hour, we're going to talk with Bob Mayer. He is the former rock critic for the Chicago Reader, who now works for the Commercial Appeal in Memphis, Tennessee. He's got a new book that's out called Trouble Boys. It's the story of the Replacements. It's a great book. It's getting a lot of buzz. He's going to be at the Hideout tomorrow at 3:00. He's being interviewed by MTV's Jessica Hopper. But it's a great story about the rise and fall and everything in between of one of America's greatest rock bands, the Replacements from Minneapolis, a band that essentially were legends but never stars. And that's what we're going to talk about coming up here on The Download. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. A new book by rock critic Bob Mayer takes on the story of The Replacements. I can't wait. book is called Trouble Boys, and it tells a story of the Minneapolis-based rock band and their rise and fall in the 80s and early 90s. But it's more than a VH1 behind the music. This is a 400-page, in-depth look at one of the most fascinating bands of our time. It's not a feel-good story, as it's littered with missed opportunities and tales of abuse, addiction, and destruction. Bob Mayer is a music critic who writes for the Memphis newspaper, The Commercial Appeal, and he's going to be on stage tomorrow being interviewed by MTV's Jessica Hopper at The Hideout. That's at 3 o'clock. Bob Mayer, welcome to The Download.
Thank you for having me.
How did you, I kind of tongue-in-cheek say this isn't a VH1's Behind the Music because it's more than just the sort of rise and fall of this rock band. This is a research project. This is a rock book.
Well, yeah, I mean, I started out not knowing that was going to be the case necessarily. I thought I was going to just tell the story of a rock band, a colorful rock band, an interesting one. But as it turned out, once I started doing the research, and it was one of those things where I thought it's going to take 2 years that ended up taking closer to about seven, as I got deeper into the story, I realized this was much more than a story of a rock and roll band. It was that, but it was also a story of abuse, addiction, as you say. It's a family story. It's a story about Midwestern families and people who came from environments steeped in alcoholism and repression, I suppose, sort of Catholic blue-collar roots, and how all those forces kind of shaped who these guys were and shaped their desperation in a sense to form the band and how all that ended up sort of carrying them through most of the 1980s.
Well, it's said in the book, you know, the Replacements are legends but not stars.
That was the case, and I think, you know, one of the things that the book is about is about their struggle to achieve a kind of commercial success at a time when bands, and they were one of the first really alternative bands signed to a major label during that time, it was still a lab experiment. You know, this is in the pre-Nirvana era. Rock radio was still very much, even though it was the 80s, it was still very much a kind of 70s model.
Yeah.
And marketing bands was still very much done that way. And they were not a video-friendly band. You know, they didn't like the idea of videos, which was the then burgeoning sort of new wave of marketing groups. And so I think they had a lot of things going against them. They had a lot of things that they sort of weren't comfortable doing. So the story becomes about this struggle to find their place within the business and the industry. And it is a weird thing is when they broke up in 1991, that was almost the start of a second life for them.
Yeah.
And they became, within a few short years and have continued to, they became kind of these legends, as you say, without being stars.
Yeah, it's amazing to me because as a kid myself, I mean, I think back to 1993, 1994, when it was like the heyday, grab every piece of alternative rock music
right.
you could. There was this search that I really feel was about authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
And it led to the Replacements.
Right.
The Replacements over and over became the band that everybody knew, even though they weren't getting played on the radio or they weren't. And WXRT here in town
sure.
played them, but they weren't on the Billboard charts. But there was something about the fact that this was as pure of a rock band, an alternative rock band, you were going to get.
And that's part of what kept them interesting. Paul Westerberg, the lead singer and songwriter, talks about that in the book. When I asked him at one point during the many years and many visits to his house, I said, you know, what if you guys had that one hit, you know, the thing that broke through and made it onto the charts and was a kind of success that you were known for? And he looked at me honestly and he said, you wouldn't be here. And so the fact that they fell short, that they're kind of ensconced in this idea of the beautiful loser, of the band that almost made it, that kept them pure and I think added to their legend and their myth and helped him. You know, I think if they'd, like I say, if they had that hit, it would have taken something away. I mean, they still would have had the great songs. They still would have had the thing, but in a weird way, their failure became a kind of success.
And it's weird as a fan to think that none of those songs were quote unquote hits.
No,
when
I mean,
you think of Can't Hardly Wait, you think right. of any of the songs that are radio friendly, and they're there, and you're like, these are in my brain when it's wired in. You're like, oh, the huge hit that was Can't Hardly Wait with the Replacements, but it wasn't.
Yeah, and the closest they really ever got to the top 40 was with a song called I'll Be You, which was on their sort of big polished major label album Don't Tell a Soul in '89, and that got up to maybe 51 on the chart. And that record, you know, they never went gold. They never had a top 40 hit. And yet there's so much more lionized and talked about than so many bands who did have hits. So in a weird way, in a funny way, it's kind of their victory wasn't for that one moment during their career, but their victory kind of became one for all time.
You know, another thing I love about this is that, you know, you do get into the family life of the band. And there's some tragic stuff with the Stinson brothers and
right.
and in Westerberg himself. But there's a lot of stories about how they came up with abuse and
right.
alcoholic parents and all the way through. And it's almost like, and I was sort of talking to Pete about this, it almost feels like, you know, rock and roll saved their lives.
That's true. It's for me, it is a story of these kids. What happens to these kids who come from these damaged American families, Midwestern families, how they deal with that damage, and they find a kind of salvation in rock and roll, and it becomes like this thing that saves them. But it only saves them for so long,
right,
and for so far. And the things catch up with him. It certainly caught up with Bob Stinson, who was kind of subject to most of the abuse. He was eventually kicked out of the band, died young at age 35. It caught up with Westerberg to a certain extent in terms of him having to deal with his drinking at the end of the band. And it really caught up with the band in a sense. I mean, the band kind of collapsed amid some of the same issues that brought them together.
The terrible beauty of this story is that rock and roll saved their lives and ultimately killed them.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what happened. The things that they were that rock and roll saved, they were the things that didn't get them to move to the next level.
To the next level. Yeah. I mean, and that's – but I think it's also that the truth and the power of their experiences that has made them resonate for so long and so deeply for so many people. I think people sensed, even, you know, before this book was written, they didn't know these things about their backgrounds. But I think people sensed on a kind of gut level that there was something powerful and painful and emotional behind those songs, mm-hmm, and behind those performances, and they connected with that. And I think that's why they've continued to mean so much to successive generations. You know, they have fans that are, you know, people who saw them at the time were in their mid-50s, and they have fans who are 18, 19, 20 who are still sort of discovering them.
What I love about the Replacements, and it's in this book as well, is their issues with consistency.
Right.
You know, they would be able to go up on stage and do a rock show for the ages, and then turn around the next day and have the big sloppy piece of chaos.
Or vice versa. You know, the first night might be bad, the second night might be genius. That is kind of the thing. I mean, some of that was, you know, in some ways a lot of, and so much of their reputation is built on their live performance, these covers heavy sets, these drunken sets, these wild, amazing shows, and the clunkers, the stinkers, and the myths, which were a kind of comedy and drama in themselves. But, you know, some of that was natural. The things that Westerberg talked about is like, we didn't go on and fake it. We played our mood. If we were bored, we played bored. If we were excited, if we were challenged by the audience, you know, mm-hmm, they reacted to what was in front of them and what the mood was of the moment. And I think, yeah, that doesn't always breed consistency, but it breeds a lot of memories for people. And I think the funny and maybe the ironic thing, in some ways, people talk more about the bad shows than the good ones, which is unfortunate because there was a lot more good shows than bad ones.
Right.
But, you know, that's sort of
that's the lore.
Yeah, that's right. The lore in a way. And you know, some of that was calculated, I think. The things they did on stage, as natural as they were, as instinctive as they were, I think as a band they also had a sense of showmanship to do little things that would, you know, lodge in people's brains, and they're still talking about them 30 years later.
Well, I mean, that's a good rock and roll band. I mean, even the bands that, you know, we've talked about, we had Rich Cohen in here talking about the Rolling Stones.
Right.
I mean, another band that, you know, imploded at some point.
Sure.
But that's, you know, they got it together to go, this is a business. You know, we have to take this, we have to be professional, we have to figure this out. It's almost the story of the Replacements until the Replacements just didn't figure it out. Mm-hmm.
Well, I saw the Stones. I remember seeing them here when I was living in Chicago and reviewed a show. They did two nights at the United Center. It's like, I remember them fumbling Satisfaction. They've been playing that for 40 years. So you get, you know, I think the really great bands, and I certainly the Replacements and the Rolling Stones have a lot of common elements in terms of their approach to playing. You know, the magic is mingled in with the mayhem. So that's kind of how it goes.
Another thing about the band, the Replacements, is it really, and you kind of pull this out, you know, in the summary of the book, but just the concept that this is one of the first indie rock bands that signs to a major label.
Right.
And we've heard that story. We've been force-fed that story for a long time about indie rock and major labels. Talk about that and the Replacements sort of being the first.
Yeah, I mean, they were among the groups in this era of, you know, post-punk America, late 70s into the early 80s, and there was this kind of rebirth of independent music in America. Certainly in the 50s, labels like Chess were independents, but this was a different kind of era. And they were the first band really to be signed by Warner Brothers, a very progressive, artist-friendly label at the time, Sire. And they were kind of guinea pigs in the way for how alternative music was marketed and sold.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of wouldn't be realized until a few years later with Nirvana, where it kind of...
Almost like they treated them like a rock band from the late 70s kind of thing. And so
you know,
very different kind of approach.
Westerberg says it in the book, too. He says, you know, we were 10 years behind or 5 years ahead. And it's true. You could almost see them fitting in with bands like The Faces or Mott the Hoople or groups like that from the early 70s, from like 10 years earlier. And you could also see them having been more commercially successful if they'd have come 5 years later in the 93, 94, when alternative radio was a much greater force. And so I think, you know, it's kind of being a band out of time in a sense. And you know, they suffered for that in the moment. But as I say, I think their greater legacy and their greater success would come, you know, in the decades that would follow.
Paul Westerberg plays, obviously, being able to get him to talk. Right. He's sort of famously reclusive, quiet. And you talk about his upbringing. That's his family. That's where it comes from. But, you know, Pete and I were talking about a nice little hour-long combo about about the book. But, you know, did the Replacements essentially have more trouble because of Paul Westerberg's personality? Meaning, he wasn't a Mick Jagger.
Right.
He wasn't this sort of, oh, the cameras are here. Oh, the mics are on. I'll talk to anybody. I mean, he's reclusive. He hid.
He was, during that era, it's funny, he was comfortable with writers, I think, because he's a writer. He was not comfortable with the other aspects of the business, you know, with TV,
the wine and dine,
labels, that kind of thing. And I think that comes from a kind of fear of success, a fear of failure. It's the Replacements were a band that was sort of governed by fear in a lot of ways. There are different fears. And I think, you know, in some ways, Tommy Stinson, who was kind of the heart and the face of the band, he would have been better suited to have been that front person. He later went on to a very successful career for many years playing with Guns N' Roses. I mean, he was kind of to the manor born. He was a born performer. He was on stage by the time he was 11. He quit high school at 15, was on the road. I mean, he was the natural rock and roller. For Westerberg, I think he was a writer who became a rock and roller because that was the only means to express himself at that time. So, yeah, I mean, there's ways you can see where Paul's personality and certainly the band took their cues from him where that hurt or impacted their career adversely. But, you know, it's one of those things where the Replacements such a delicate and special thing, sort of the alchemy of the four of them. It had to be the way it was to turn out that way.
I mean, the chemistry of the four together, I mean, they stumbled around to find that.
Right.
But they really didn't have as much success independently, even Tommy working with Guns N' Roses and Paul Westerberg's solo career.
Yeah.
But they didn't never were able to find the chemistry they had when working together.
I think those kinds of – those powerful things that you have as a young man that you find with this group. And as Paul said, you know, they were governed by their limitations. You know, Paul says in the book, there wasn't a high school diploma or a driver's license between them. And that's true. Like literally none of them could drive. None of them had graduated from high school. So I think that breeds a certain kind of desperation. And that's what brought Paul and Bob, you know, together and kind of created that first bond. And then later as the band continued on, that bond kind of shifted between them and went to Paul and Tommy. And of course, Chris Marrs was kind of like, you know, if everybody's fire and ice, he's the lukewarm water in between. So these dynamics shift and change. And I think the idea of the Replacements was ultimately consistent. It was this thing of like, even without Bob in the band and he left sort of midway through, they still carried on that thing. But I think once it was done in 91, they never quite recaptured that spark. And I just don't think there's any way to do that because, you know, that's a once in a lifetime thing. And when they reunited eventually in 2013 and did these shows, including a you know big show at Riot Fest here in Chicago, it really was a thing of like they're playing those songs and it's just Paul and Tommy at this point. But even just the two of them, they still had that magic that moved people. So
and still the same issues that made them implode.
Right.
You know, Chicago does play a role in the Replacement story. That was the infamous Taste of Chicago
show, which was their final show.
I mean, they broke up off stage, right?
Yeah, they handed off their instruments to the roadies and walked off stage, and that was it—a kind of symbolic handing off. And then, of course, they reunited. The second show they played in their reunion, 2013, was at a park as well here in Chicago. So, and even early on, I mean, some of their first shows they did outside of the immediate you know Minneapolis, Wisconsin area were in Chicago, playing with Husker Du and like the song Kids Don't Follow, which is the first song off their second album, Stink, and this very iconic song. That was written kind of here in Chicago and performed for the first time here. So, Chicago, the upper Midwest, you know, figures very prominently in the Replacement story and certainly the Windy City, maybe more than almost any other city.
For you as a music critic, I mean, you have so many different things you have to write. I mean, that's your job.
Sure.
You're a writer. You write about different bands. To be able to put a project like this together, do you feel almost like a kindred connection to the Replacements now? Do you feel like what's your thought about the band after this being done and now you're starting to go on the circuit? Like, where's your heart at when it comes to the Replacements?
Well, I think for me, and you know, because I'm uncovering a lot of truths about the band, and it wasn't my intention to, I didn't set out to demythologize them in any way. I think maybe in some ways I add to the mythology, but I wanted to tell a true story, a real story, a human story. And when you do that, and you do it for as long as I have, and you come to know the people involved, not just the band but their families, it becomes a really serious and emotional process for me. Certainly when you're talking about abuse and some of the things they went through and people recounting memories, right, you know, for me, a relative stranger that they hadn't even talked about amongst themselves. So it was a very intense experience, more than probably I expected or was even prepared for. So I, in some ways, I feel like I don't want to say I'm part of the story, but it's certainly I feel like I've said my part about it, and it's part of the bigger record now. So yeah, I mean, I feel an attachment to him, and I feel a greater admiration now. I think some people walk away from the book feeling like, oh man, I almost wish I hadn't read that. I didn't want to know all this. But I think in the same breath they'll also say, but I'm glad you did it, right. You know, and that's how I feel about it. It's like, yeah, it was a harrowing experience for me to go through this and to try and write this in a challenge. But at the end of the day, I'm really proud with the way it came out, because I think it tells an important human story as well as a rock and roll story.
Well, personally, I want to go home and listen to all the Replacement records I can.
Well, hopefully that's what it does for everybody. That would be the ultimate.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know,
the book is called Trouble Boys. It's the true story of the Replacements. The author is Bob Mayer. He writes for the Commercial Appeal in Memphis. Also worked here at The Reader back in the mid-2000s.
Yep.
Bob, thanks for being my guest, and I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Well, this weekend, the Chicago Sinfonietta wraps up their season with a big bang. It's a concert that combines art, science, and music. It's called Cosmic Convergence, and it's the product of a collaboration between the Chicago Sinfonietta and Emmy-nominated scientist and visual artist Dr. Jose Francisco Salgado. The show's at Wentz Hall in Naperville tomorrow night. It's going to be at the Chicago Symphony Center on Monday night, and Dr. Salgado is here tonight. Dr. Salgado, thanks for being my guest.
I'm delighted to be here.
It's not every day we get an Emmy-nominated scientist in here. I mean, that's sort of an oxymoron, right? I mean,
yeah, it's not something necessarily that, you know, go hand in hand, Emmy nominated and scientist.
Right.
But yeah, it's 2006. I had a segment, a weekly segment with Univision Chicago, and every Wednesday I would go to the studio and talk about astronomy and answer questions submitted by viewers. And I did that for 2 years, and it got
there
an Emmy nomination. So.
All right, so let's talk about this collaboration, because this is a collaboration with the Chicago Sinfonietta that's been going on for about a decade.
Yes, a decade.
So talk about how the origins of that collaboration and how it's evolved over the years.
So by 2005, I was already combining graphic arts with science and astronomy just to get people interested. By that I mean make something that was very visually appealing, and people would say, like, oh, what is this? And then I could explain the science behind it.
Okay.
So I would combine astronomical images with, you know...
So like planets and solar systems, things like
right.
that.
Right, yeah. And artwork in the sense that, for example, faraway galaxies combined with terrestrial landscapes and so on, just to create a piece of art that would make people wonder about what that was, and then I could, you know, communicate some science. So the Sinfonietta approached me, and they asked, they asked me if I could make a visual backdrop for the two concerts that they were having in 2006. And by that, I interpreted it as could be as simple as a pretty slideshow.
Right.
Because, I mean, the images of the planets from, let's say, the NASA spacecraft are so impressive and so beautiful that you could just show them in the concert hall while the orchestra plays, and people, you know, will be in awe, with the images. But I thought that would not necessarily contribute to the concert experience. If any, it would distract people from the music. So I agreed to work on the project, and I said, I think that this is my chance, first of all, to move from stills and, you know, photography and Photoshop work, illustration, into motion graphics and film. And because I'm such a you know, music lover. I'm very, very passionate about music in general. I wanted to do something that would respect the music. So I said, I can make a film that follows very closely the character and the tempo of the music such a way that it would have to be presented synchronized with the live music.
Exactly. So it's not unlike what we see from, you know, concerts, almost even at the Oscars or other places where they have clips up there and the orchestra's playing along. But this is much more synchronized. What I'm interested in is, you know, do you get the music ahead of, I mean, when you talk about collaboration, how does a collaboration work? You get the music ahead of time?
For this particular case, you know, the origin of the collaboration was the suite The Planets by Gustav Holst, mm-hmm. right? A suite that was written 100 years ago. So although Holst was more interested and he was inspired by the astrological aspects of the planets, nevertheless, it's thematic. And other people had actually attempted to put visuals to the music. So in that sense, yes, I'm working with music that has already been composed. Right. And I have people ask me, what are the challenges? Well, the challenges are, and they are good challenges. I have the constraints of following music that has already been composed, and there's no way that I can change it or that I can ask the composer, oh, could you?
Yeah, it's not, right, exactly.
Because could you lengthen this part, or could you, you know, I have to make the film fit the music and not the other way around.
So,
right?
So places where the music, yeah, where there's crescendo or climax or the music gets louder or softer, you have to find artistic images along the lines of astronomy that match that.
Exactly.
That's not that easy to do.
Exactly.
Especially when you're dealing with, you know, images that are
right.
space.
Right. And in Hollywood, you know, so the conductor and the composer are basically following the film and they're making the music fit the film. I'm making the film fit the music.
Yeah.
And so anyway, like I said, it's a challenge, but it's a good challenge to have. Now, from there on, that project was so successful that I said, oh, this is what I should be doing in life. You know?
In life, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be making more of these. So for the second one, we said, okay, what can we do? And I remember having telephone conversations with, you know, Maestro Freeman and the executive director of the orchestra. And somebody said, oh, what about pictures at an exhibition? And I took that idea and I said, okay, that suggestion. I said, okay, pictures at an exhibition. I know that Mussorgsky was inspired by some particular paintings, actually by a painter that was a friend of his who had died. I said, I know, as an astronomer, I know that astronomical images are so beautiful that many of them do look like artwork.
Right.
And it's like the universe is painting these masterpieces, you know, for us. So I said, what I can do is, you know, during the promenade, which is the theme that gets repeated, and Mussorgsky wanted to take the listener through galleries and then have particular movements inspired by those particular paintings. I said, I can take the concert goer through these galleries that will lead to astronomical images that will serve as portals into space. So by using 3D graphics,
wow.
That was the second production.
And all this stuff of the collaboration with the symphony and Sinfonietta and your work as an astronomer, I mean, have you had an opportunity to sort of feel the way that science and art and music interconnect, you know, not just from a sense of, oh, I'm going to put these images to the music that's been offered to me, but are you seeing something because of your diverse roles and the fact that you have such a diverse background, a connection between these things?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and one informs the other. And for example, if you take music, you can just, you know, listen to beautiful music and appreciate it, but you can also study it by using physics. Because if you think about it, sound is physics, right? It's acoustics,
mm-hmm.
And music is as well. So you can study frequencies and wavelengths and, you know, timbre and beats and all of these things, actually, like things like beats. It's something that you study in physics when you're studying, you know, general physics course and you go through, you know, mechanical waves, all of these things. And actually, the musicians, they know about these things from the musical side, right? Not necessarily from the physical one,
right?
But they intersect, and to create artwork, you use tools, and those tools were created with science, right? And so science gets applied to make instruments,
not only acoustic instruments,
but
instruments to paint. So it's safe to say that science is involved in art and music because, I mean, at the earliest moments.
Right. And another example is photography. So, of course, you take photographs to express yourself, you know, creatively, but you also use photography and imaging in general to do science. And astronomy is a perfect example because astronomy is very, very visual. And do you know that, for example, CCDs were developed for astronomical research?
Really?
Yes. And then they were used in consumer cameras. But I remember the term CCD not because, you know, you could go to Best Buy and get a camera with a CCD sensor, but in astronomy, it was like a big leap from, oh, you know, we had film and photographic plates. Now we can use these electronic devices called CCDs.
How have you evolved? I mean, with Cosmic Convergence coming together here in 2016, your work, you know, from that moment in 2005, 2006 with Planets where you said, oh, I'm going to do this forever. How has your work evolved? What are we going to see on Saturday and Monday that shows the course of your work?
It has evolved in the sense that the resource material that I researched was mostly from NASA and historical illustrations from historical archives, and then I started integrating my own work, and by that I mean not only 3D graphics that I created and so on, but my photography. Mm-hmm. And I have been taking pictures since I was like 13 years old, so pictures at an exhibition had one movement with my photography, but then it kept evolving in such a way that now we have this piece called Borealis that we're going to present with Chicago Sinfonietta for the first time here in Chicago. And it's 10 minutes of the Northern Lights as seen from Northern Canada. And every single frame is based on a photograph. So it's what we call time-lapse photography, right?
Right,
where you program your camera and you take photographs in sequence. So that's completely no 3D graphics, no animations, no illustrations. It's all pure photography.
Oh, man, sometimes, you know, Pete knows this. Sometimes I'm like, I'm going to be here. I'm going to miss it on Monday at Chicago Symphony Center. It sounds great. Dr. Jose Francisco Salgado, the Chicago Sinfonietta's Cosmic Convergence. It's a multimedia concert that combines classical music and science to honor the collaboration between Dr. Salgado. It's going to be Saturday at Wentz Hall in Naperville. That's tomorrow in Wentz Hall. And then again at the Chicago Symphony Center here in Chicago on Monday night. Dr. Salgado, thanks for being here. Thanks for talking about your work. And congratulations on the premieres.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. It's Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. God, so many good things, you know. It's funny, Pete, because we've had such a tremendous, tremendous week when it comes to things that you should check out in Chicago. I mean, we went all the way to the Death and Harry Houdini at the House Theater, which we talked about, the Anarchist Songbook.
Haymarket, yeah.
The Haymarket Show. Chris Jones yesterday talking about a lot of stuff that's coming up here, the show that's at the Goodman, Lorraine Hansberry's show. Bob Mayer is going to be with Jessica Hopper from MTV. I say that now like she's always been at MTV. But MTV's Jessica Hopper will be at the Hideout tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Monday night is not only this show, the Cosmic Convergence, which is awesome, at Chicago Symphony Center, also in Wentz Hall in Naperville. But Monday night's also Robbie Foulkes is back in town.
Ugh.
He's doing the it just escaped me what his theme is for tomorrow night.
Yeah, forget it.
It was like, I think he was doing Bob Dylan. But anyway, I mean, there's so many great things. It's amazing to me. I feel like I'm falling on the sword for Chicago. You know, like I'll do the interviews to get everybody interested in this stuff, but I can't go.
Yeah, because you can't.
It's a bummer.
It is.
Ashley Weider was here on Monday. Cinderella is wrapping up this weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Tonight, Scott Carter with the show at Northlight. Oh, man.
What I do is on Facebook, I'm interested in a lot of things. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, this sounds good. I'm interested.
Yeah,
I'm
right. Interested. You're an interested kind of guy.
And then on Monday, this Monday, it'll come up like, it says, you have 72 events this week. And then I look at it and they're all.
Do you think if you didn't have this job, you've worked at other places, are you an events kind of guy? I mean, do you always go to, how many events would you go to per week?
Maybe one during the midweek, and we still do stuff on the weekends now, but maybe one, not too often, every night or anything like that.
There's so much culture, arts and culture here in the Chicago area. I mean, you could go every night and see like world-class stuff.
Yeah. I mean, if it was free, if there's free things to do, I mean, you can't go out 5 days a week, seeing Broadway in Chicago, but yeah.
I know, I wonder, because my fear would be if I didn't have this job and I was into the arts, I would be like, I'd have the ability and I just wouldn't go.
Right.
I'd be like, oh, well, that sounds good.
Yeah.
But there's so much TV on.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, God, I got to watch I got to watch LeBron James.
I don't mean to bring up something bad happened, but was watching the Cubs game during that interview. If you notice, I wasn't paying attention to that interview
because I
saw Jason Hayward went head first into the right field wall.
It's early.
He
in
made
the game,
like a
right?
diving catch.
Is he out? Is he hurt?
And they took him. He looked like he was in extreme pain.
Oh man, you got to be kidding me! So that's two outfielders on the shelf. Hopefully, that's only.
Oh yeah,
a
we
DL
don't know the.
Stint.
We have send Hawk down to Hawk Harrelson. If he was there, he'd be checking on the. But
I wonder if,
I don't know how serious it is, but.
What's going on? What'd I miss?
Jason Hayward got hurt.
Oh, I saw that, yeah.
So I don't know. We don't know how serious it is. On the South side right now, the White Sox are getting beat by the Royals, 4-1.
Yeah, so, that's not good.
Not good, but yeah, that's no good. That's no good that Hayward. Because, they've been having, at the beginning, it's really interesting about the Cubs, because the Cubs are still the best team in baseball, and it's early, and who cares?
Yeah.
But, we had said with Schwarber, there's plenty of people to take his place. Well, Jorge Soler is not doing well. He's in a prolonged slump.
Yeah.
I mean, he strikes out a lot. Maybe there's a reason why he was only being platooned in certain situations. And Jason Hayward, he's been on and off. He's been hurt a little bit. He took some time off for his wrist. He's got one home run. And now this. I mean, I think you're going to see Matt Scherr.
That's Caesar.
Tommy LaStella and Dexter Fowler outfield in a couple minutes here.
I think you'll have Chris Bryan out there and Ben Zobrist and put in Tommy LaStella in the infield and Javi Baez. I mean, they have
such a they can play anywhere.
They can still do it, but yeah, that hurts. He'll be fine.
All right. Well, let's take a break. Coming up here in the 10 o'clock hour, 312-981-7200. You know what time it is. It's the frying pan. Steve Gadlin. 10 o'clock. Stay with us.
I looked in a frying pan. I sing a song.
Oh, you got to love that. When you hear that sound, you know what time it is. It's Friday night at 10 o'clock. 312-981-7200 because it's time to put Shark Tank Steve Gadlin into the frying pan. Gadlin is the brain behind the successful local business I Want to Draw a Cat for You.com. He's presented his business idea on the television program Shark Tank, and he snagged Mark Cuban as a principal investor. So now Steve has to go back to Mark Cuban with new ideas. Before he goes into that pressure cooker, he comes to WGN Radio to jump into the frying pan. He's giving us his exclusive business ideas so we can poke holes in it and give Steve the confidence he needs to pitch it to Mark Cuban himself. Steve Gadlin, welcome to the frying pan.
Hey, thanks, Justin.
Good to hear you, buddy. How you been?
Yeah, I've been doing okay. I actually spoke to a couple classrooms of fifth graders today to inspire them with my innovation entrepreneurship. So we'll have a lot of excellent young leaders coming up in the world.
Wow, so you, okay, that's good that you got that opportunity. That's,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good. Okay. Well, you know what? Let's get to it. This week, obviously, last week, the Star Wars electric banana peeler didn't go so well.
Right.
I've heard a lot of people.
I think, you know, people weren't even listening to what the product did. They were so hung up by the Star Wars tie-in. Mm-hmm. That I think, you know, that one deserves a second chance. But I'm ready to move on to a new product.
It's surprising to me because this week, throughout the week, there have been a lot of people continuing to text their disdain for that product.
Really?
Yeah, like it's usually just for Friday night, but I'd be like Tuesday and I'd be doing something completely different. And they're like, hey, tell Steve Gadlin that idea is terrible. So just let you know that obviously resonated. I mean, sometimes, you know, at least you're getting their attention. That's good. All right.
Well, no publicity is bad publicity, as they say.
That's what they do say, sort of. Okay, so let's go. Steve Gadlin, what's your idea for this week's frying pan?
Yeah, you'll have to pardon me if I seem a little overconfident tonight, but I've got a winner. So kids these days, am I right? They love to wear their hats in all different directions, and you never know, you know, based on the day of the week, which way the kids will be wearing their caps. Sometimes they wear the bill in the front.
Right.
Sometimes it's on the back.
Right.
Sometimes to the left and sometimes to the right. So I've created an invention so you don't need four different caps. It's called the snap cap. Now, the snap cap is a round skull cap with snaps around it, and it comes with four different bills. So if you want to wear the bill in the front of the cap, you snap on the front bill. If you want to wear the bill in the back, you snap on the back bill or one of the side bills if you want your hat tilted to the side. So it's the single cap that serves all purposes. You know, the styles can change day by day. With the snap cap, you can even change it throughout the day. It comes with a carrying case, so you can carry the bills you're not using with you in case you need to change your fashion sometime during the day.
All right, snap cap. You know what? I like it. There's a couple questions, but like I usually will defer to the Download Nation. 312-981-7200. What do we think, Download? We think yay or nay on snap cap, a cap that has removable bills. Mm-hmm. So it can fit any of your cap fashion needs.
Yeah, in any configuration. It doesn't have to be just one bill. You could walk around with looking like Sherlock Holmes by snapping on two bills if you're going to a costume party. And, of course, you can brand the center part with a sports team or a video game or something like that, whatever kids are putting on caps these days. Mm-hmm. And as a parent of kids, it allows you to just buy one cap for them and know that they won't be ridiculed at school because they'll be able to fit whatever the fashion happens to be that week.
Right. Well, I don't know how anyone would have a problem with this one. But let's take a quick break. We'll line up the phone calls. The texts are already coming in. There's people on the line. 312-981-7200. What do we think of snap cap? That's Steve Gadlin's latest idea for the frying pan. Stay with us.
I looked in a frying pan, I sang a song.
It's a frying pan here on WGN Radio. It's Friday night at 10. So that means innovator, entrepreneur, and inventor Steve Gadlin joins us. He was the man behind IWantToDrawCatForYou.com. He won on Shark Tank. He now has a development deal with Mark Cuban, so before he brings his ideas to Mark, he brings them here to the Download to workshop. Tonight's idea, snap cap. Steve.
Yeah, so the snap cap is a baseball cap, but unlike a normal cap, it only lets you wear it in one configuration. This comes with four bills that are removable, so you can snap on whichever bill you want to use. And I think for parents, this type of thing is a great idea because your kids are in a minefield called school where one thing's popular one day and then not popular the next day. So snap cap with its handy carrying case allows your kid to change their cap configuration based on the style of the day. Maybe that's bill forward, bill backward, bill to the one of the sides.
Mm-hmm. Okay, 312-981-7200. Let's go to the phones. Diane, yay or nay to snap cap?
Yeah, I called. Yeah, I don't get it because if you're doing different teams, you obviously need different colors. If you're doing it just for the side, front, back, side, side, why don't you just take your good old hand and turn it around?
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Manually, it seems like, right, Diane, I agree with you on this one. Manually, seemed by using your hand, you can adjust which way the hat is.
Well, you know, I guess the more I think about it, I suppose that is one way to change the configuration of your hat. But why lock yourself into that sort of manual? It just seems better to me to have a hat that's a little more flexible than that, mm-hmm. where you could change it from front to back to side by snapping on the bill. Plus, if you want to put on two or three or wear all four bills, that's an option that you
You
have.
Can do multiple bills.
If you're
right.
If you're just manually, right. And we don't know where Styles going to go.
630 says, I like it, depending on price point.
That's great. So we are probably thinking about $35 for the starter kit, which comes with just the skull cap. Without the bills, and then $15 per bill. But now you can mix and match and get bills of different colors with different branding on them.
Right.
So really, we're not thinking people will stop at four bills. Some people might buy 20 bills so they can, you know, again, mix and match. And, you know, and it comes with a carrying case. That part's for free with the skull cap.
He also has a question. Can you put different team logos and that sort of thing on the cap?
Well, you can purchase, you know, most caps, if you look at them, have the team logo on the part that goes over your head, not on the bill. So you can probably purchase multiple skull caps with different team logos on them.
Okay, well, there you go. So you can do that.
Yeah. You know, we're thinking people are going to see this as an investment. It's a system, you know, like a workout system. You invest in the product and the system, and then for life, you'll have interchangeable caps and bills.
Okay. Let's go to Dan. Dan, you're on the download. Yay or nay to SnapCap?
Yeah, it's a nay.
Why?
Yeah, I don't. Well, I'm like the last caller. You can move it. You can move a hat. For $35, you can buy four caps. And what are the snaps going to look like? Are they, you know, can you see them on the hat portion?
Yeah, great question. Thanks, Dan.
Well, they're snaps. You know, so yeah, you can see them. They're little tabs, little fabric tabs that will go over the snaps.
Okay, so but they're visible.
Well, it depends. I mean, not everyone's going to stick their face up in your cap.
Right. Okay.
Maybe I'm not explaining it right. It's a skull cap with snaps lining the perimeter, and then you can wear the bill of the cap in any configuration you want.
I think we get it. I think they get it. Let's see here. Let me get something here.
The way hats are now, you have to buy a front-facing cap, or some kids buy backwards caps, or side-to-side caps. This allows you to buy one cap, and then with several bills, you know, change that configuration on the fly if the style happens to change.
262 says
your personal taste changes.
Yeah, 262 says yes, I love it. That way, the logo will always be facing forward.
Exactly. See, this person understands.
There you go.
That's something, you know, that is an idea I had, but something I forgot to say is that because of this, the logo always faces front, no matter where you put the bill.
312-981-7200. SnapCap is the idea tonight from Steve Gadlin. While we're waiting for the calls, Pete's talking to some people on the line. A basic question, I think one that's probably generic for 847. How did this guy get in front of Mark Cuban to begin with?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So there's a television show called Shark Tank, and I applied to be on the show with my very innovative stick figure cat drawing company, and they put me on the show. So by nature of being on the show, I got in front of him, and he was very impressed with my pitch.
Man, that was what it would, yeah. Okay. So 312 says, loves it. Is it only a cap? Can it do things on the internet?
Well, it does have Bluetooth compatibility with your phone so that you can browse other compatible bills and caps. Mm-hmm.
You know, Justin, I have to say, your tone is pretty skeptical tonight, but I'm hearing a lot of yays come through on these checks.
I'm sorry.
So,
you know what, I'm trying to deal with that because I know that I can, sometimes I don't even know I'm being skeptical. And I apologize. So thank you for calling that out.
No,
it's probably
it's
a blood sugar thing more than anything.
It's not offensive to me. I'm just mentioning it.
Thanks. 630 says, I could see this product being a hit with the same people that have multiple Fitbit bands. So maybe there's something in there, yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, since it's Bluetooth compatible, it will work with your Fitbit, too.
Okay. Well, a lot going on here. I'm interested if I – so you said the price point is $35 and then $15 a bill.
Yeah, so $35 for the plain skull cap with all the snaps already installed, and that comes with a carrying case for all the bills you might purchase, and then $15 per bill. And when you think about it, you know, an official ball cap is usually about $75, $80. So this pretty much pays for itself after two or three wearings.
Okay, well, I don't know if it's $75, $80.
I'm talking
that.
Official... you know, licensed, like the hats that the Cubs or the Sox actually wear.
Yeah.
Autographed.
724 says, Steve is a genius.
Thank you.
I usually go to sleep, so I've never really heard Frying Pan. Steve, here's an idea. Cat PJs.
Oh, yeah, the cat's pajamas. I've heard that idea. That's an idea that I've had.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. Okay. There's a lot of comments here, and I'm trying to – it's funny because I'm trying to keep them because there's some really colorful good stuff here. I think people are starting to get the idea that I read those at the end, so it's hard for me because I don't want to waste such good stuff. People are really doing justice here.
I'm feeling pretty good.
Yeah, okay.
So far.
Well, the first half of the Frying Pan is over, and it seems like there have been some yays and a couple of nays. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We got an opportunity here, right?
Yeah. I'm thinking of getting I might call Mark tonight.
I mean, right now it seemed very positive, and here comes some more phone calls. So what we'll do is we'll take a break. We'll get Rob Martier's news. And then we will definitely see what these people have to say because it really we're kind of at 50-50. Steve Gadlin's idea tonight, SnapCap, not so bad. Stay with us. All right. Coming up here, we will have the second half of the Frying Pan tonight, 312-981-7200. Rob Martier, what do you think of SnapCap?
I don't know. You know, I'm kind of, like right now, I'm kind of lukewarm on the idea. I'm not going to dismiss it. I think I would have to see kind of the actual product.
Like maybe if you got a cool model that showed it in different forms.
I'd wear it. I'd give it a test. I'd walk up and down Michigan Avenue with it, see what kind of response I'd get.
There we go. All right, we'll see. Well, we'll see if their phone lines are here and the texts are coming in. We'll see if Steve has a fighting chance in the second half of tonight's Frying Pan. The idea, snap cap, a skull cap with snaps, and you can apply a bill to it to position your cap one way or the other, whichever way you think you want it for the fashion of the day.
I looked in a frying pan, I sing a song.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Exciting here because it's time for the Frying Pan. It's Friday night at 10 o'clock, so that means that Steve Gadlin, the entrepreneur, the innovator, the inventor, Steve Gadlin, is in studio. I want to draw a cat for you.com. One on Shark Tank. He's got a development deal with Mark Cuban. Before he brings new ideas to Cuban, he brings them here to workshop on the download in the Frying Pan. Tonight's idea, SnapCap, Steve Gadlin.
Yeah, so the SnapCap is, you know, a lot of people these days have to buy four different hats. Because they don't know from one day to the next what's in fashion. A cap with the bill in front, to the side, to the back, or to the other side. So the snap cap is a system that allows you to buy one skull cap and several bills, and there are snaps around the edges so that you can wear that bill in any configuration you want.
And hey, if you want to go crazy, you can wear several bills at once.
All right. Well, like we said at the right before the news, we said heading into the home stretch here in the frying pan, it was pretty close. It was pretty close. It was like
It was overwhelmingly positive.
No. Most of the calls were nay, and there were some yays with some exceptions. But it was closer than usual. So if you have a strong second half of the frying pan tonight for SnapCap, we might have a winner. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Bob. Bob, yay or nay on SnapCap?
Well, you know, before I put my idea out on the 50,000-watt blowtorch, I want to say that it was Steve that inspired me to this revolutionary idea that is going to change the face of the fashion world. And Steve, if you don't do it, I'm going to be teaming up with your buddy, and we're going to be taking over. Hmm. But Velcro, see, I like your idea, but we're limited to four positions. But with Velcro, the possibilities are endless.
Yeah.
And you don't just have to have four. You could have as many as you could stick on there. And in virtually any position. Plus, you know, the snaps, they rust and things like that. Velcro, that's the way to go. What do you think?
You know, here's the thing. Part of wearing a hat.
Don't be jealous. Don't be a hater.
Well, it's making a fashion statement, and part of that fashion statement is auditory. So Velcro makes a sound that is these days, especially by kids, seen as cliche and almost embarrassing. Where a snap, when you pop that bill on and off, you get that real nice, quick snap sound. Velcro.
That's kind of upsetting. Velcro has a lovely, smooth pulling sound. When you think about it.
Well, I'll say, too, that Velcro is an idea that I already had and is something we have in development, too.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you had my idea? Come on now, Steve.
Yeah.
Come on.
So I had thought of that earlier.
Well, I hope all I could say is when you go home and you look in the mirror, okay, we need to face the fact that this was my idea.
Ooh. Well, I'm looking in the mirror.
I'm not even willing
right
to. You don't even have to pay me royalties for the idea. Just take it. I was put on earth to benefit mankind, and this idea is, I'm giving it to you.
Okay. Well, that's very nice of you,
Bob.
Well,
you can't really give me my own idea. I think that's a cop-out.
All right. Well, I think what Bob was saying is that he brought the idea up. You then, after the fact, said that you had the same idea in development.
Well, but before the fact, I had the idea already.
All right. Well, let's go to John. John, yay or nay on SnapCap.
Hello there.
Hi.
How are you guys?
We're pretty good. What do you think of SnapCap?
Good.
Yay or nay on the idea?
I think it's pretty good.
All right.
Are you going to have exterior, metal snaps? Or
yes.
Why don't you go with an interior Velcro?
Oh,
yeah.
We just had the big fight with the Velcro,
Yeah.
And then I would go with, you know how you're working out in the sun?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have a little flap in the back so your neck doesn't get burnt.
Yeah.
That would be a great idea.
Well, you can just
It's an easy stealable idea. You know, like I think the gentleman before said, hey, if you're not going to do it, he's going to do it or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's jump on it now and see what you can do.
Well,
because you know how any patent is, you know, anything, all you have to do is modify it, and it becomes a new thing. But I think a nice little flap in the back, so if you're working in the garden,
right,
you don't burn
protecting
the back
your
of your neck.
Back, yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of women would love that. And, you know, just a short bill, or it doesn't have to be a long bill in the front.
Right.
Anything like that. I mean, I know you said you had various sizes, and you could put them in various shapes. I mean, you know, that kind of reminds me with the guy that used to have that little beanie with the umbrella on it. But
Yeah, real similar.
Hey, but you know what? The guy made a lot of money.
This is about money. Thanks, John. Thanks for that. So you're getting a lot of modifications here. A little Velcro,
maybe a flap in
the back.
Mm-hmm. These are all ideas that I'm pretty sure I mentioned at the top of the show. Hmm. So, you know, these are yays. They're supporting the ideas that I've come up with.
847 says, I have to vote no for Velcro. Hmm. I don't think that the guy has ever had his hair caught in Velcro. Terrible.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. That's why I thought of it and then decided against it.
Oh, okay, okay. 312 wants to know, how about Star Wars snaps?
Star Wars, yeah. You know, we're thinking maybe some CP3P snaps. You know, that'll cost a little extra.
815. Go ahead.
No, it does cost. It turns out it does cost me a little bit to use CP3P in a product.
Okay,
so,
well, there you go. That's pretty much all of your argument last week. A little bit of Google search would have figured that
out. I was in the right, but I just misunderstood what they were saying. So that was their. They should have enunciated.
Right. 815 says, makes me think of the purse you bought and then paid for covers with different designs to snap on.
Yeah.
It was a huge hit.
Yeah, huge hit. So I'm hearing a yay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 312-981-7200. 724 says, P.S., Steve is a genius. And P.S.S., this is Steve's brother. So that's
well, I don't have a brother. So it's not my brother. Maybe it's Steve Bertrand's brother.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. One here, 724, says he wants two kits, and he gives his credit card number.
So oh, perfect. Perfect. Well, they're not for sale yet.
What are you talking about? I mean, what needs to happen for these to go to market?
Well, I need some pretty significant investment to, right now it's just sketches in a notebook on some Post-its. So we'll need to make them. And I haven't really started figuring out how that would happen.
Okay. 312-981-7200 is the number. Okay. What we're going to do is we'll take a quick break. We'll wrap it up. Mm-hmm. We'll come back and I'll read all the, colorful texts that have been coming in, for SnapCap. It's the frying pan. Stay with us.
I looked in a frying pan. I sing a song.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. Shark Tank Steve Gadlin is in the frying pan tonight. His idea, SnapCap, which is... Go ahead, Steve. Give us the elevator pitch here.
Yeah, it's a skull cap with snaps all around. Mm-hmm. So instead of having to buy four caps to wear in different configurations, you know, bill in the front, bill in the back, bill to one of the sides, mm-hmm. you buy one cap and several bills that can snap on in any configuration you like.
Okay, great.
Saves you a lot of money, a lot of time.
All right. Let's get to more the text that came in tonight, some really good ones, some pretty straight-ahead, straightforward ones, creative ones. 847 starts us off with sad and dumb. Sad and dumb.
Okay, well, interesting.
Okay.
Interesting.
All right. One says, 630 says, so you don't need four caps. That's it.
Right. You just need one cap so that you can, you know, wear a bill in any configuration.
Right. 815 says, worst of the worst, the frying pan. 779 says, dumb, dumb, dumb. This guy's a riot.
Now, where is 779? Who's listening to the show?
This is a good one. For all of us, sleep is to rejuvenate mind and body and spirit. For some of us, it's to expand and reinvent imagination. You, sir, are not part of the last.
Okay.
I think that means that you don't rejuvenate and re-expand your imagination.
Okay. Well, I'll keep that in mind when I lay my head on my pillow tonight.
708 says, I asked my cousin's horse, and the horse said, nay!
Well, that's not fair. You can, if we're only asking horses, it'll be all nays. That's what they say. That's what horses say.
Right. They don't go, yay!
Right.
Yeah. 219 says, you couldn't invent your way out of a wet paper bag.
Okay, well, that's your opinion, but I did win on Shark Tank, so.
Yeah, you did. That's right. This guy, 630, this guy's an insult to your listeners.
Okay.
That's really harsh.
Yeah.
Well,
I think saying that is an insult to the listeners, so that's this person is the insult.
Mm-hmm. 320 says, what a whack job.
Okay.
847 says, hey, compared to this guy, I'm a genius.
Okay, so the scales are tipping. That's all. Yeah. I'll acknowledge that much. But I think it's, well, I'm sorry.
All right, here's one that I think hits close to home. 847 says, you know what? He says that you sound skeptical. He's talking about me. So he said, Steve says that you sound skeptical. But he doesn't admit how defensive he is. His biggest downfall is, and this is all caps, his attitude and his cockiness.
Well, this person texts weekly.
Yeah.
Don't they? I wish they'd call. I wish they'd call to have a real conversation about this with me, because I listen to these. Believe me, I listen to every episode of this 3 or 4 times between each taping. And I think I sound pretty intelligent. Mm-hmm. I think it's the callers that sound like they're missing the mark. So.
Right. Well, you're not going to endear yourself to the callers. You know that you're going to say they're missing the mark. 312 says
not all of them are all there.
I know, but that
a little dim.
Again, I think you're just you're antagonizing them in a way that these are the people who are going to decide whether or not your product's good, and maybe they're maybe they're getting emotional because you sometimes come off defensive and cocky.
But they're antagonizing me first, so. Oh, okay. Yeah.
312 says, I just tuned in, but this guy seems like the kid who thought he was awesome because his parents told him he was. My limited knowledge says this idea is terrible. Can't knock the enthusiasm and the ideas, but come on, this is terrible.
Well, I'll tell you, where I got my confidence was the sports camp my parents sent me to, which was there were no balls. It was entirely pantomime. And we got to win every game, so right, I'm just carrying that through to life.
Yeah. 312 says this moron is brilliant. I think that's good.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good. They got my name wrong, but...
Yeah. Okay. 708 says, this is C-3PO, I'm suing you. That's good.
Well, once again, my device from last week used the droid CP3P, not C-3PO.
Oh, right. 847 says, he sounds very boring. He better put some life in his voice when he meets with Mark Cuban again.
Well, you know, if you had watched my original Shark Tank video, I think you'll see I had quite a bit of enthusiasm.
Yeah, you did. 847 says, this is just so stupid. This guy has nothing. This guy never has anything good.
So. Okay, well, what do they do? That's what I'd like to know. How many inventions have they put on Shark Tank?
I mean, 847 says we're giving him constructive advice, not criticism.
Yeah, well, I'm getting a lot of criticism.
Well, 773 says this guy is so hostile. Is this some sort of performance art?
You know, advice sounds like, hey, good job. Here's something else you can add to it. And actually, we did get a lot of calls like that tonight. Mm-hmm. But a lot of these texters, that's where the criticism comes in. And I don't think there's really much room for criticism when I present ideas that are solid winners. Maybe if I were coming with zingers, you know, or ding-dong ideas, that might be more, right. I don't know.
312 says, if this guy was younger than 23 years old, this may make sense, but he sounds older.
Well, I am older than 23. Mm-hmm. Though to look at me, you wouldn't know it, because I've kept up.
And the final, you're fit. That's one thing. And the final one tonight, which is a astute comment, is from 312, and it says, Donald Trump is a fan of Shark Tank. So there you go.
Okay. So. Well, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump. I don't like to get political, but I'll lay that out right now. Not a big fan.
Okay, well. I think that it's hard to say. I think this started really well, and we really put a lot of pressure on the second half. You started the second half off by arguing and getting defensive and taking credit for everybody's ideas. That may have spiraled into more hate than usual on Twitter.
Did I mention the Bluetooth compatibility?
You did. Yeah, you did.
Okay, just want to make sure I got that in.
Yeah, you got it in. So I would say that you're almost there. This one was pretty good. Maybe it's one that you can bring back, and maybe we could do like a new segment on the frying pan where we say, hey, it's time for the revised frying pan, and you come back with like a concept that you've done before.
But your listeners would be game for that.
I think they would. I think I'm telling you, Steve, I know that this comes across very negative, this segment, but this is by far the most interaction we have on the program, meaning on the download, there's 100+ texts and calls. People call in. They do want to give you their thoughts on the piece. So
you know what? That is a good feeling. And I know it's like having hundreds of older brothers and sisters who are just looking out for my best interests. Right. But you got to know, the younger sibling doesn't always respond to that in the moment in the best way.
Right.
But as I lay down at night, I think of all these people and I love them for their advice. So
847 gives us the last parting wisdom tonight with the text. Hey, this guy is okay.
There you go.
Steve Gadlin from IWantToDrawACatForYou.com, from Shark Tank. We will continue the frying pan next week. You're going to be here in studio. I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm coming in.
All right.
I got a good one for you.
All right, great. Steve Gadlin, thanks again, buddy.
Yeah, we'll talk soon. Take care.
That was a good one. Good frying pan. Snap cap. Not a bad idea, I think, but this is the point. The point we make is that it's not just about the idea. It's also about the pitch. And in this case, once the pitch started to get a little bit out of Steve's hands, the defensiveness crept up, which we've been working on for a year.
I noticed he put the phone down rather aggressively.
Yeah.
Did you catch that?
At the end, yeah.
Yeah.
I know it gets to him. And those are the little things he can do because he does take it very seriously. And so how about you, he slams and then maybe he does like a primal scream when the microphones and the phones are off. You know,
he's going to go draw a really angry cat now.
Exactly. Big plans this weekend, Rob?
Got some yard work to get done.
Yeah.
I've got to tear down an old shed to make way for a new shed, which I'm affectionately referring to as my summer home because it was so expensive.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So you had to buy a whole new shed?
Oh, it's awful.
Pete said he's not doing anything this weekend, so he'll come and help you.
Grab a crowbar. Come on out.
Well, we will look forward to hearing the results on Monday. Have yourself a great week. What do you got going on, Pete?
What are you worrying about, Jason Hayward?
That's the weekend?
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. Sounds good. I am going to I'm actually going to do some yard work as well. I'm starting to get into gardening, and I've decided that might be my my new thing.
How's the hydrangea doing?
It's great. It's awesome.
Yeah, green.
It's killing
thumb.
It. It's killing it. I might go get another one this weekend.
Oh yeah.
Needs a friend. Needs a sibling. So we'll see.